On this episode, I had the privilege of hosting Yossi Klein Halevi. Yossi is an American Israeli. He is a senior fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem and a really well-known author, a passionate Zionist, and somebody who really lives between the two worlds of America and Israel. With Yossi, we talked about extremism, about the Kahana phenomena. Who was Benjamin Kahana? Meir Kahana. Eventually, we got to the conclusion that he was actually a loser, even though now his successors will say otherwise. And Yossi brought up a really strong message to world Jewry. So I really encourage you to listen to the episode all the way to the end and share it also with others. And on the same level, I would like to tell everybody, Shana Tova and Chatima Tova, and may this year bring us peace and abundance on a personal level and on a national and international level. Kol Tov. Welcome to Balagan, Yossi Klein Halevi. Such an honor to have you here.
Well, Kobi, it's great to be with you. And balagan is exactly the right word because I feel like I'm living in a balagan, a nonstop chaos, nonstop upside down world. And so welcome to balagan, really.
I thought that I chose the correct word to emphasize on what's happening in Israel.
When did you begin the podcast?
So I started it almost 3.5 years ago in the COVID era because I thought it can be a great resource for people who are not knowledgeable about what's happening in Israel, but they want to learn more and they want to get a better context actually on things that are happening. And it was a really nice thing to do. I was sitting home. I had other friends sitting home. So I started recording conversations with them. And from that, it moved on. And now we're already at the third season.
Well, it's amazing that you chose the name Balagan then, because in retrospect, we were living in this calm, semi-normal Israel. I mean, Israel's never normal, but yeah. compared to the situation now. So yeah, Balagan was a prophetic, Kobi.
Yossi, you also experienced some Balagan in your life. I mean, and you're also living both worlds, Israel and the US. So let's start by telling us a little bit about yourself and let's call it your American background.
I grew up in a neighborhood that was technically part of America, but not culturally or psychologically. We were still somewhere between Eastern Europe and Brooklyn. I grew up in Borough Park, which in the 1960s and 70s, when I was young, was the largest concentration of Holocaust survivors in America, maybe the world, most of whom were Orthodox and increasingly Haredi, ultra-Orthodox. Now, the Borough Park that I grew up in was already becoming ultra-Orthodox, but our family was what used to be called modern Orthodox. And it's interesting to think back to those years because the shock of the Holocaust created a kind of a softening among the survivors. You didn't have the same rigid boundaries that you have today. I grew up very comfortable in the ultra-Orthodox world, even though, as I say, we were not ultra-Orthodox. The synagogue that we prayed in was Hasidic. And everyone, including the children, wore black hats. And my father wanted to make a statement. So we wore green hats, green fedoras, instead of black. But we were very much a part of that world. We went to bungalow colonies together with the families that later became Satmar. And when I look at my family album, I see pictures of women who really later became the pillars of Satmar Bikur Cholim. The women in Satmar have a very well-developed system of visiting the sick in New York hospitals. And these were pillars, really, of the Satmar community in bikinis in the late 1950s, early 60s. And it was so close to the Shoah that people were still in a state of shock and the lines hadn't yet hardened. So I feel very privileged, actually, to have grown up in such close proximity to a world which I no longer have any connection to, the Haredi world. But I did get to know it at that crucial moment just before it hardened and became triumphalist. It was still soft. It was still approachable and somehow less judgmental. And so it was an upbringing. It was a very unusual upbringing, certainly for American Jewry. But even within the survivor community, Borough Park was a very specific experience. And at the same time, I grew up in an intensely Zionist family. And my father was very anti-Haredi. I mean, this is the funny thing, you know.
And he was a modern Orthodox.
He was. And so what were we doing in Borough Park? All of his friends were there. Anyone from his town who had survived moved to Borough Park. And so there really was this sense of being part of it, but also to some extent being outsiders because of the Zionism issue. And my father was very angry at his friends who were sending their children to Haredi yeshivas, because he said, you know, the Haredi world failed. It failed to warn us about the Shoah. And my father was very angry at the Satmar Rebbe, who was, of course, the leading anti-Zionist of that generation. And he blamed the Satmar Rebbe for the deaths of his friends, many of whom, he said, would have gone to Israel before the war. But the Satmar Rebbe forbade his followers from leaving. And then he, of course, was saved by a Zionist, by Kastner. So I grew up with this deep sense of belonging and not belonging. And that really transitioned for me into my teenage years as a Jewish activist. I became part of the Soviet Jewry protest movement, which was really just beginning in those years. I'm talking about 1965, 66. And I was a kid, I was 12, but I started going to the demonstrations and became kind of the mascot of the Soviet Jewry movement and really grew up in it. And then at a certain point, this was the late 1960s, Meir Kahana emerges and founds the Jewish Defense League, the JDL. And initially, the JDL was focused on protecting Jews in urban neighborhoods who were being physically attacked. And I was part of that. I was part of the street patrols in Borough Park, for example. But what really deepened my relationship with the JDL was when Kahana moved into the Soviet Jewry struggle. And Kahana had a very strong critique of the peaceful nature of the protest movement. He said that we're never going to get anywhere if we keep walking in circles and chanting our nice slogans. He said the only way the media pays attention to a political movement is if there's violence. And I was 16, 17 at the time, and that made a lot of sense to me. It was also the late 60s when political violence was the norm in the US. And American culture of the late 60s, if you look at the films of those years, was really celebrating violence. Bonnie and Clyde, Easy Rider, you know, there was this sense of violence in the air, and Kahana really capitalized on that. And so I became part of the JDL. I didn't realize it at the time, Kobe, but I was present at the birth of one of the most monstrous phenomenon in Jewish life today, which is what we now call in Israel Kahanism. It worked a little bit differently in America. It wasn't focused on the Palestinians, and it wasn't overtly racist, although I think there were signs of racism then as well. But it was really more, as I say, focused on diaspora issues, on protecting vulnerable American Jews, and then especially protecting Soviet Jews and trying to push open the gates of the Soviet Union.
I want to ask you, first thing for our listeners, that it may be their first time listening about the struggle to set Soviet Union Jews free. Through the Cold War era, Jews in the Soviet Union were banned from leaving the Soviet Union, and they were also banned. They could not leave as Jews. They had to live as communists, as you call it. And they had no freedom of religion and no way to preserve their Jewishness. They were called refuseniks, right? Because they refused to stand down with the communist regime. And there was a really strong movement here in the US of the Jewish communities that were leading the call to help them to break out from the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. I think that the Soviet Jewry movement is the greatest and least told story of the diaspora in the post-Holocaust era. It wasn't only in America. It was all over the Jewish world, from Australia to Argentina. And it lasted for 25 years. It began in 1964. I joined a year later, a year after the founding of the Soviet Jewry movement. And it ended in 1989 with the opening of the gates.
Of the gates.
There was nothing that can compare to the intensity, to the determination, the solidarity that the Soviet Jewry movement created within the diaspora. It's unimaginable today, given the deep divisions within the Jewish people. It's hard to believe that it was only 30 years ago that Jews were united almost across the board. The one community that did not participate in the Soviet Jewry movement were the Haredim. But everyone else, you know, the Reform, the Orthodox, the modern Orthodox, secular, left-wing, right-wing, it was an extraordinary achievement. And it only got stronger. When I joined the movement, it was very small, almost marginal. We would have a few thousand people coming out for our demonstrations. And then gradually it became such a powerful movement that the last great Soviet Jewry demonstration, which was in Washington in 1987, when Gorbachev came to meet with Reagan, there were 250,000 demonstrators. And for my generation, that the generation that began the movement, it was inconceivable that we would ever get to those numbers and to that level of importance. And that's why, by the way, that I was drawn to Kahana, because I felt we're so few that the only way we have a chance of making an impact is if we really draw media attention to acts of violence and desperation. But the truth is that the Soviet Jewry movement was so much bigger than Kahana. And Kahana in the end was wrong, because what ended up happening was that slowly the movement spread and the acts of violence became marginal and irrelevant and were replaced by a massive, massive presence in the streets and, no less important, tremendous support in Congress. And the Jackson-Vanik Amendment of 1974, which connected levels of Soviet Jewish emigration to American trade credits, which was unbelievable that this law passed. But the Jackson-Vanik Amendment really was the moment, I think, that American Jewry became truly a political force. That was the moment when American Jewry realized that it had power, and it learned not to be afraid to use its power. Because until the Soviet Jewry movement, the American Jewish community was very timid. Jews would protest for civil rights, for Vietnam, were very reluctant to go out into the streets as Jews. And it was the Soviet Jewry movement that really changed the nature of the Jewish community and created the community that we know today.
We can speak a lot about that, because I actually think I'm one of the ones who, before I moved to the US and I didn't know anything about American Jewry, as a Zionist, I was like, oh, everybody should come to Israel, and everybody came to Israel. I mean, I thought it's like a small, it's a minority. And then when I moved here and I saw this huge community with all of these organizations and crazy infrastructure and network, and I started learning about their history, and I saw how much American Jewry actually shaped, I would say, American society in so many ways. I would say that it's a disgrace that it's not being taught as a part of Jewish history.
And Israelis, as you well know, don't know this story at all.
No.
And that's really a disgrace. The truth is that the two communities, the two most important Jewish communities in the world, know almost nothing about each other. We don't know each other's culture. We don't know each other's Jewish life. And one of the reasons that I'm so happy to be speaking with you, Kobi, is because I've long felt that the two groups of Jews in the world today who really understand each other most are American Jews who moved to Israel and Israelis who moved to America. Because we speak the same language, and I mean that literally. We speak a kind of a Hebrewish, you know.
Yes.
I raised my children in half English, half Hebrew. But more deeply, Israelis in America and American Jews in Israel really understand these two communities. And we should be in conversation with each other, especially at this moment, in trying to figure out how do we strengthen the connection between American Jewry and Israeli Jewry.
I completely agree with you on that. I think, you know, we're lacking, a lot of things are getting lost in translation, as it's called. And we can be what you can call the living bridge between the
and
two
communities. Where we can be cultural translators. And
yes,
that's really the work that you're doing with this podcast. And it's the work that I've been trying to do all these years as an American Jewish Israeli who spends a great deal of time flying back and forth between JFK and Ben Gurion.
Now I want to go back to Meir Kahana, because I think that from what we see in Israel now, we have everybody, you know, there is no dispute that this is the most extremist, hard right-wing government ever elected in Israel. And one of its pillars is actually two extremist parties. One of them is called Otzma Yehudit, and the other one is Jewish Power. And the other one is Atzionut Adatit, religious Zionism. One is led by Bezalel Smotrich, who is a Chardal. And by the way, I spoke about it in my third episode of this season. And the other one is Itamar Ben-Gvir, who for many Israelis is considered to be Meir Kahana's successor. So before we go into what's happening in Israel, I think that it's important to give in a nutshell, who was Meir Kahana, and then explain to me what was his source of power and how he got to so many, I would say, young Jews and influenced them.
Well, it's interesting because if you look at Kahana's life, he was a failure in his life. Today, one can say, unfortunately, that he's one of the most influential Jews of the 20th century. And what Kahana did when he moved to Israel is reinvent himself from a leader of a violent political fringe movement to the leader of a religiously fundamentalist, messianic, apocalyptic fringe movement. And the change is very important. The shift from being a political and ideological figure, not particularly religious in his message in America, to focusing his entire message on visions of messianism, of apocalypse, of living in the end of days. And Kahana really combined far-right politics with religious fundamentalism and messianism, and took everything to its farthest extreme. And I actually was present at that transition. I saw it happen. In 1973, Kahana ran for the first time for the Knesset. He failed to get in. It was just before the Yom Kippur War. Mm-hmm. And I was there in Israel as a student. I went to Hebrew University for my junior, what's called the junior year abroad, my third year of college. And of course, I went to see Mayor Kahana and to volunteer. He was running for the Knesset, so I went to volunteer. And I began to realize this is not the same agenda. And this is, it's Kahana wasn't interested anymore in the diaspora. He wasn't interested in Soviet Jewry anymore. His focus was the Arab threat, as he put it, the Arab cancer in Israel, and the need to transfer, to expel. And he wasn't only talking about Palestinians in the West Bank, or even primarily Palestinians. He was talking about Arab citizens of Israel. And I left him. I walked away and never looked back and never had anything more to do with him. That was the last of my involvement with Kahana. And almost all of my friends from the JDL ended up leaving him as well. So when he moved to Israel, he not only changed his ideological emphasis, but also lost the people who were with him in his early years. And what I realized from watching him in 1973, watching him up close, and as I say, initially being involved in his campaign, was that Kahana was transferring his Brooklyn mentality to Israel. Israel did not need a Jewish Defense League. We have a Jewish Defense League. It's called the IDF. And Kahana looked at the Arabs and he said, ah, these are the same thugs who are attacking Jews in Brooklyn neighborhoods. Well, it's a little more complicated than that, isn't it? And so that was the first mistake that he made. And that, I think, was responsible for him being marginal in his own life. Look, he won election once. He got in 1984.
Yeah.
And it was only him. It was a one-man party. And then the Knesset banned him. The Likud, under Yitzhak Shamir, banned Kahana. So he was completely peripheral, irrelevant during his own lifetime. Because he was so American, he had this diaspora mindset, which did not fit into Israeli politics. But ironically, it was only after he died that his ideas began to take deep root. And maybe he had to die and not be the diasporist that he was in order for his ideas to become, quote, Israeli. And that's what happened. Ideas that were on the periphery have become increasingly mainstream in certain circles. You know, I don't want to overstate it because Kahanism is still not mainstream for the Israeli mainstream, but it is in parts of the right. It has become much more respectable. And to my mind, it is now one of the greatest existential threats, literally an existential threat to Israel's future. And I think back to what the roots of this phenomenon were in Brooklyn among Jews who felt defenseless, felt vulnerable, and were looking for some way to protect ourselves or to protect Soviet Jews who were even more vulnerable than Jews in Brooklyn. And then making the transition to the farthest fringes of Israeli politics. And now to see, as you put it, Mayor Kahana's successor, and I think Ben-Gvir is Kahana's successor. He is the Israelized version of Kahana. Ben-Gvir's genius was to figure out how to make Kahana sound Israeli. And he's now in charge of the police. Mayor Kahana is in charge of the Israeli police. It's a nightmare. And I keep waiting to wake up. And I keep reminding myself, this is actually happening. Kahana has taken over the Israeli police.
As we speak, it's Erev Rosh Hashanah. And this weekend, it's actually going to be the 37th week in a row that Israelis are going to rally in the streets. And when you look at what's happening in Israel, I think that what a lot of people don't understand is that eventually the struggle now, or what's happening in Israel, is actually a fight on Israel's identity, whether it will stay a liberal democracy as a Jewish and democratic state, or it will transition to a lot less democratic, in the better scenario, to a far-right wing, messianic and religious state. And a lot of Americans are asking themselves, and not just Americans, but I know that in other countries as well, the Jewish communities don't really know how to react to that. And I want to ask you, you are one of the loudest voices who actually speak American and is bringing your voice. And I want to hear more from you about how you see the situation today, and how do you think American Jewry or world Jewry can support Israel or help Israel at this point?
I believe that this is an existential moment for Israel. And if, God forbid, Israel becomes a Jewish version of Hungary or Poland, we will lose the Israeli success story. The Israeli economy will start to decline. Israeli social solidarity, on which our defense depends, will unravel. It's already beginning to unravel. Most of the diaspora, I think, will start drifting away from Israel. We know that's already happening, but it's going to intensify. And Israel cannot afford to be a dictatorship or an autocracy in the way that Hungary or Poland, which are part of the EU, can be. Those countries are not facing existential enemies. They're not facing Iran or Hezbollah and Hamas and Syria on their borders. We can't afford to lose our moral credibility. And as we all know, we've been struggling in these last years to maintain our moral credibility in the world. It's not easy. And if this happens, then we're in a, really, I think, a life and death situation. And it won't be immediate, but I think that over the long term, Israel will gradually become a non-viable state. And that's my nightmare. You're going to see large numbers of young Israelis who are the backbone of Startup Nation leaving, and leaving for a reason that Israelis never left before, leaving for ideological reasons, an emigration of despair. And that's what worries me. So it's one thing to leave for professional opportunities, for family reasons, because you're curious about the big world and you've lived in this little country all those years. And it's another thing to say, I can't breathe in this country, and this country is a threat to my values, and I can't be here anymore. That's a tragedy. That's not emigration. That's mass flight. And I don't believe that Israel will survive in the long term if that takes root. So I've been very involved in this struggle for the same reason, I think, that I was involved in the Soviet Jewry struggle as a boy, because I care most passionately about the well-being and the physical protection of the Jewish people. And that was my commitment growing up as the son of a Holocaust survivor. That's what my father taught me. And I feel that what we're doing now is a direct continuation of my lifelong commitment to trying to help protect the Jewish people. that includes the work I've done over the years, going to campuses and speaking out against anti-Zionism and the BDS movement. This, for me, is part of the same struggle. And you mentioned about the diaspora, and I don't have a strong voice in Israel. My career has really been built on speaking as an Israeli to the American Jewish community. Yeah. My readers are almost all in the diaspora. And so I write in English, I speak in English. And so I'm trying to use these 40 plus years of life in Israel and working, as you put it, as a bridge between these two communities, and trying to use whatever capital I've gathered to cash in at this moment and tell the diaspora, tell American Jewry, I've been in dialogue with you for my whole life, and even more intensively when I became an Israeli. And you know what my commitments are, and I'm telling you that you need to pay attention to the democracy movement, and you need to support the democracy movement. Because this is, as you put it earlier, Kobe, this is not about left or right. The democracy movement extends from moderate left to center to moderate right. And it is, to my mind, the most hopeful and beautiful phenomenon that I've experienced in many years. And I go to these demonstrations to be inspired, not only to protest. I come back and I feel uplifted. I feel that we're going to win, because there you are standing with thousands of other Israelis who you know are going through exactly what you are. They're not sleeping because of their anxieties for the future of the country. They are consumed with love for Israel. They would do anything for Israel. These are people who served in the army, who fought, who are ready to give their lives, whose children served in the army. And now this is a continuation of that same commitment to protect Israel. And my appeal to the diaspora is, just as diaspora Jews stood with us at crucial moments when Israel was threatened from without, 1967 and 1973 and the Second Intifada and the Gulf War, stand with us now, because this is no less a danger to Israel than the Yom Kippur War.
It's a really powerful message, Yossi. I can totally understand what you were saying, that you're going to the protest because it's an uplifting experience. I had the privilege of attending several protest rallies in Kaplan in the past half a year. And it was a really amazing experience, because it made me feel proud of being Israeli. And it's all full of love to the country. And I'm working here with a group of Israelis who are trying to elevate the conversations. And my experience is that actually this can be a turning point for many Americans who shied away from speaking about Israel because they were ashamed of what's happening, or they felt embarrassed, or they felt they cannot connect to this type of a country. Some call it apartheid state, all of those arguments. And now I think there is a chance for us as Israelis and for us as Americans to reunite, create a new dialogue between us, and strengthen the bond of the Jewish people.
Absolutely. I think you've put it beautifully. This is an opportunity for diaspora-Israel relations. And it's a crisis, but it's a crisis in the sense of an opportunity. I'm so appreciative of the demonstrators who will be going out to greet Prime Minister Netanyahu when he comes to the UN. I hope you'll be all out there in force. You know, the Israeli Prime Minister is coming to New York. Jews should welcome him. I think it's only natural. So, give him the welcome that we're giving him in Israel. And so this is really a time for American Jews to reaffirm the Israel that they believe in, the Israel that they love. And we are recreating that Israel every week in the streets. And it is a movement that's going to last. I believe that we owe Netanyahu a great debt because he has changed the lazy culture of the center, of my camp, the political center, which, you know, settler violence, yeah, it's just a fringe. The Haredi state within a state, yeah, you know, it'll work out somehow. Nothing works out on its own. Everything is now on the table. And thanks to Netanyahu and this criminal government, this morally criminal government, we now have a whole new force in Israeli society, which is an activated center. It's not left-wing, but it is passionately committed to Israel as a Jewish and democratic state and will not compromise on either of those two identities. And this is an invitation to the diaspora to join us in reaffirming Israel as a Jewish and democratic state.
I will say amen to that. Yossi, it was amazing to have you here. I really want to thank you for the conversation and for this open invitation to American Jewry. Listen to what Yossi said and join the rallies wherever you are. Support the movement around the world. And regardless, by the way, if you want to read, I mean, Yossi is an amazing author. He didn't ask me to say that, but I am saying it because I read two of your books. I read, of course, Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor, which I loved it. I mean, it was really, it portrayed beautifully a conversation of what you want to say to somebody if you want to coexist, I would say. And then also I read your book, like Dreamers, who are talking about the Tzanchanim, the paratroopers who liberated the Kotel. But I want to recommend a book that I'm going to read now, which is your memoirs. It's called A Memoir of a Jewish Extremist.
Yes.
Which talks about your background and your years with Meir Kahana.
Well, so, Kobi, well, after you read it, let me know what you think.
I would, and
then you'll have to let me know if you would ever have me on again after reading that book.
I'm quite sure I will. I'm quite sure I will because I love unique life stories, and you definitely hold one.
Well, Kobi, thank you. Thank you, first of all, for everything that you do for Israel, for American Jewish Israeli relations. And thank you for having me on. It was really a pleasure to be with you.
Same here, Yossi. Shana tova v'chatima tova to you and your loved ones. And shana tova v'chatima tova to our audience around the world.
Shana tova, everyone. Thank you.
If you found this episode enlightening or thought-provoking, be sure to subscribe to Balagan on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And hey, if you're feeling extra generous, leave me a review. Your feedback means the world to me and helps others to discover the show. Of course, sharing the episode link with others will also be greatly appreciated. Remember, the conversation doesn't have to stop here. Join me on Balagan's Facebook group to continue discussing today's episode and connect with fellow listeners. I would love to hear your thoughts, questions, and suggestions for future topics. You are more than welcome to check my website, www.balaganil.com, for additional resources. I'm committed to connecting you with Israel and providing you with proper context. Until the next time, remember that knowledge is power. Keep learning, keep growing, and continue engaging with Israel. I can't wait to catch you in the next episode of Balagan.